I need new chairs in here.
I am okay.
That is what I don't normally do.
Thank you.
The hour of 9:30 having arrived, I'll call the meeting to order. I think what we like to do, first of all, is kind of dispense of our normal business activity. We have approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Properly moved and second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Ayes have it. Approval of the minutes of September 11th. Have all of you had a chance to read their minutes? We entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Properly moved and second that we approve the minutes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Abstain. Mr. Chairman, not having been able to attend that meeting, as I was stuck on a bus the entire time in September 11th traffic.
I'm sure you abstained for the opportunity to also say that, but we will accept your abstention.
I have heard it before.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And motion passed. Okay, we will hold our action items till later. Start with our informational items. Metro Transit Police. To General Manager, if you like to...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would like to first open the meeting with a statement by taking a moment to thank Senator Cardin, Senator Warner, House Majority Leader Hoyer, and Representative Davis, and the entire congressional delegation of this region. I'd like to commend our champions in Congress for introducing and passing legislation in the U.S. House and Senate to provide federal dedicated funding for Metro. It is an acknowledgement by many in Congress that Metro is vital not only to the workings of this region, but in particular to the federal government. The passage of this bill in Congress comes at a perfect moment. Metro has just completed an inventory of our capital needs from 2010 to 2020. To fully fund those needs would require $11.3 billion. With this inventory of needs, we have the tools to shape Metro's future. With the proper funding like that was passed last night, we can fix the crumbling platforms within our stations. This would help reduce crowding on our trains by providing 8-car trains during the peak periods on every train that's in operation. Again, it would help us replace the 1,000 series rail cars, which are approaching 35 years of age, and they are showing it. We can grow the Metro bus and access service fleets to meet the ridership demands we know are coming. We can operate express Metro bus services using bus-only lanes throughout the region. With the proper funding, we can improve the signage on our stations and expand the use of credit cards in our parking facilities. With the proper funding, we can do all of these things and more. This legislation is the key that opens the door to all of these opportunities. We look forward to continuing our partnership with the federal government and local jurisdictions to resolve our funding challenges. To those members of Congress who work so hard to bring this bill to passage, believe me, I cannot stress our gratitude enough. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. General Manager. Any comments for the board? Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In a year that has been almost unrelievedly bleak in transportation terms, especially transportation funding terms, this is a ray of sunshine, and so it is most welcome. At the same time, it would be a mistake for anyone to think that we now have $1.5 billion. What we have is a step forward on the way to getting what has been a plan for $3 billion over 10 years committed from all levels of government in this region. And one important step, the federal commitment has now made a big advance. We still have to be able to secure the comparable matching monies from Virginia, Maryland, and the district. At the moment, of course, Virginia, which at the beginning of this year was clearly on the table with clearly dedicated new revenues for that purpose, now the one that seems farthest from providing it. So that remains a big question, and I think this action by Congress poses a challenge to Richmond to basically step up to the plate finally and do something. They reconvene in January, and I'm hopeful that they will be convinced by this action to move something along. But there are many other actions that have to be taken, and so we're not there yet, but this is an important step, and I can all take some comfort in the fact that we've made an advance this year that no one had expected, which to some degree will help us make up the ground that otherwise lost.
Supervisor Hudgens?
Thank you. My comments are not drastically enhanced from what Mr. Zimmerman has said. I think it's so important that we do acknowledge the role of the congressional delegation. Senator Warner was quite clear and open in his support for it and acknowledging the role of transit in providing the support. I think it will serve, I think, as the marker that we need. We are talking about deficits here and the challenges that we face. I think the question's been answered that there is a commitment and that we have to continue that commitment. Virginia is challenged at this point, but I think it's no different than other challenges that we face, and we faced it at the authority, and we faced it as, I think, regional partners. That expectation is there, this one again. So it was a late night vote, and I think it was a very good vote, and I think it was this affirmation to really what the nation's transit system should be. That's really the important part, I think, that will continue.
I'm extremely pleased that the House and the Senate have acted, and I presume that the President will sign this bill. It does mark a major, major step. It recognizes the fact that we are America's transit system. It recognizes the fact that we carry very large numbers of federal officials to and from their jobs every day. It recognizes the fact that without Metro, the nation's capital would not work, and it also recognizes the fact that substantial amounts of land throughout this area are federally owned and don't pay taxes, and that this is another way for the federal government to provide support than in other cities around the country is provided by the local business community. And here our business community truly is the federal government. There is a challenge, however, for us at this point. Before anything happens, we have got to change our compact. And our compact is an agreement among the federal government, the state of Maryland, the District of Columbia, the Commonwealth of Virginia. All four groups need to pass compact amendments. And as we approach those groups, it's extremely important that we work with them to make sure that we have legislation that all of them can in fact pass. And I challenge us, the board members, to work very hard on trying to make sure that each of us, working with our respective jurisdictions, will in fact put together legislation or help the staff put together legislation that will be able to pass in, ideally, in the very next legislative session, which is only a few weeks away.
With that note, and let me also commend the members of the House and Senate who took this action at probably one of the most difficult times in this country's history, in light of our economic times. Having been a former legislator, I understand that when you have to put up the tough vote, and this was definitely a very difficult vote during this environment, not that the action itself something that was not needed, but in fact the environment made it probably even more difficult. I would just like to add to Mr. Benjamin's statement that at the time that Metro was founded, there was a real sense of regionalism that writing the compact, I think there was a sense there that this is an institution that was vital to this region, and it allowed people to step back and swallow some of their fairly partisan and parochial views and recognize the goodness of the whole. I think it's important that as we go through this next phase of Metro's life, that same view and vision of those a number of years ago carries the order of the day. If not, we can then now find ourselves being the obstacle to the goal line. All the lobbying and the presentations and the discussions and of our staff and members and everyone in front of the Hill and all of the explanations of why we need this, where we got the support of people externally, it would be a tragedy if our own internal issues would cause us not to have some sense of unison as we go forth in supporting the needs for a unified compact. So I will just kind of put that marker down and hope that all that need to hear will hear. But with that, it's a great day. Getting back to our agenda, and I noticed that I did not give Mr. Francis his day in the sun. Chief, if you will allow me, if you will stay in with us, let me allow that to occur and get back to operational performance.
Thank you, Mr. Linden, and members of the committee. Next slide. The next slide is just a snapshot of a preview of our performance matrix for the month of August. I'll be talking about each one of these items in the presentation. Next slide. A bus on-time performance for the month of August. Have good news, is 75%. We compare that with the industry average. As you can see, the industry average is 75%. Right now, we're still in the process of gathering data and utilizing that data to make some decisions on how we go further in enhancing our performance on a bus operation. Next slide. One of the reasons that on-time performance has gone on the incline is you will see that our mean distance between failure for the month of August rose about 1,000 miles to 6,047. The mean distance by fleet, you'll see the average, the CNG is about 21,000 miles, the hybrid is 11,000, and on the average, the clean diesel is 18,000. Next slide. Rail on-time performance for the month of August is at 94%. Next slide. We had some discussion last committee about the rail car door malfunctions. Bring your attention to the note at the bottom. We operate 262 trains. This is combined with AM and PM rush hour. Using an average of 21 weekdays, we actually operate 5,502 trains per month. Of that, in the month of August, 1.4% of those trains had some type of door malfunction, of which less than 1% resulted in offload. Next slide. And this is during the non-peak rush hours. As you can see, we operate 2,730 trains per month. And this resulted in 2.3% of those trains having a door problem. But again, it was less than 1% as far as offloads are concerned. Next slide is also just giving you a little bit more on the rail. Things that affect on-time performance, as you can see, is ATC and the brake malfunction. All was still under 1%. Escalator and elevator availability. Our escalators were available 92.5% of the time. Elevators was 97.1% of the time. Next slide. What we did different in this escalator slide this time, we were showing you month by month the number of escalators that were out of service. And what we talked about in the previous slide was availability. What we looked at is you can still have a number of escalators or elevators out of service, but your availability can still be 83 or 84%. If you notice here, for example, you look at DuPont Circle, they had six times where they were out of service, and the availability is 25%. So now what we're taking a look at is from that perspective, and then working with our elevator and escalator personnel that have a plan associated with getting the ones that are less available, having a plan to get them back into service.
Is there availability goal, performance goal that's...
Well, our availability goal for escalators is 93%. That's the overall goal. But the goal on all of these is to get these escalators back in service as soon as possible. Next slide. And the same applies for the elevators, too. We use the same technique in looking at these, going back and looking at the ones that are out of service, but the amount of time they actually were out of service. Next slide.
If I can go back to... Keep going.
And the last slide is on Metro Access, and as we discussed in the committee meetings, Metro Access ridership continues to grow. It was at 16%. And the good sign is they're still maintaining the 92.5% on-time performance. But on missed trips, they exceeded their goal because, in this particular case, low is better, and it's at 1.5%. That's the end of the operations performance report.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Chief?
Hey, good morning, Mr. Vice Chairman, other members of this committee. I thank you again for affording me the opportunity to come and talk about crime statistics as it relates to safety and security in the Metro system. The things that the Metro Transit Police, in conjunction with other law enforcement and other WMATA employees, are doing to ensure that the safety and security of our riding passengers and employees are safeguarded. As in the past, we provided you with a five-year look at the crimes in the system and three-quarters of the calendar year 2008. We also need to take into account that during those years, ridership has increased tremendously. So as looking at the aggravated assaults, and these are Part 1 crimes, the more serious crimes that are committed, they are tracking to be below what they were in 2007. In the case of larcenies, as is the case throughout the region, thefts from autos, things of that nature, they're tracking to be a little bit above the last year's numbers of 688, as well as the case of robberies. We've had a rash of iPods and other types of things being stolen from people riding in our system. We also were asked to provide to you, based on the signatories, those types of crimes that are the top 10 and the top 10 stations within the Metro system. And in the District of Columbia, Anacostia, by far, is neck and neck with Gallery Place as the highest area that we have the most instances of crime. In Maryland, New Carlton and Largo Town Center, those two are locations that have parking facilities, and that attributes to a variety of the types of crimes associated with parking lots. Vienna, Springfield, on the Virginia side, again, those are parking areas that preponderance of the crime that we experience are happening there. Next slide. Again, we always say that one crime is one crime too many in the Metro system, but if you look at the millions of passengers that we carry, we average about 2.52 crimes per customer, per million customers. If you go back one more, that previous slide, we always give statistics on calls for services and arrests and citations, but one that could be noted in the area of arrest, back on the 23rd of September, a subject juvenile was arrested in the Capitol Heights area. He had been involved in an armed carjacking with a weapon. That subject was arrested, and the gun was also recovered. And we worked closely with the Metropolitan Police in turning over that case to them. That's just an example of what we do. Back in June of 2008, we received board approval for the 28 new law enforcement positions, and to date, we've recruited 13 of those people. Currently, we have 450 authorized sworn police positions. 30 of those officers are assigned to administrative functions, and this was a bullet that was requested from the last board meetings. But those administrative officers also assist in patrol. Every week they go out and so provide patrol for the system. Currently, the question was asked how many bilingual officers we have. We have 20 sworn members that are bilingual. We normally recruit at job fairs, military bases, college campuses, internets, and we pay a particular effort in going out, getting the best men and women to be a part of this police department. The question was asked as it relates to overtime. Minimum manpower personnel staffing is one of the leaders in overtime, holidays, court time, and training. In the area of training, that is a requirement that we have to satisfy the Maryland Police Training Commission as well as the Department of Criminal Justice Services, so we are limited in what we can and cannot do as it relates to training. Officers collectively spent about 219 hours per week attending court, and that was a question that was asked at the last board meeting, and the average overtime pay for officers is $39.68.
Chief, would you have any idea, is any of that overtime reimbursable, charged to any particular event?
Not in this case. There are a few officers that we receive grants from the Department of Homeland Security. They sort of relate to those people who assign explosive ordnance, and they are specific funding that will pay for those officers. But the other officers, you don't get any grants or funds from any other sources.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Finished?
Yes, sir.
Mayor?
Chief, I may have been reading and missed the point, the last one on the time spent in court. I thought someone was going to get a comparison, like for the last 2 or 3 years or 5 years. But cost here seems to be close to $500,000 or just slightly less than $500,000. How can we determine whether that's reasonable or unreasonable?
Well, I will provide that information, and I think there was a study back in 2005 from the Department of Justice that looked at the Washington metropolitan area, and we are on track with all of the Montgomery County, District of Columbia, Arlington, Fairfax, as it relates to overtime associated with those activities. The officers are very active. They go out and they make arrests, and they have to adhere to the regulations that requires them to come to court. And as one of the negotiated contractual things is that when they appear in court, more often than not, if they're there for 1 hour or 3 hours, they get a minimum of 3 hours overtime. That's uniform throughout the metropolitan area.
Okay, thank you.
I didn't know that. Did you know that?
That's why I
asked. Another question?
I just had another question regarding the statistic regarding the Part 1 crimes for customers. Do we have a jurisdictional measurement that we, the statistics that we have from our jurisdiction?
Could yes, be good? And yes, we do. And in previous presentations, we had looked at that. We have the cumulative numbers of crimes that's reported from the District of Columbia, Fairfax, and when we do a chart depiction of that, I think talk without. And Montgomery County, I think there were 160,000. So we had about 1,500, 1,200. So statistically, crimes that we have, part ones, are very, very low in comparison to the jurisdictions that we serve as the metro system serve.
I guess I was asking that if I would look at part one crimes for each of the jurisdictions and the relative customer measurement as to what part one crimes are in those jurisdictions.
The number of inhabitants of the Washington metropolitan area, 3.2 million, I would think that it would still result in a very small amount as it relates to the Washington metro system and crimes that are committed in that system. Because we carry these people on a daily basis, and I could get you that information.
Okay, just from a relative standpoint of looking at what it means when we're looking at part one crimes in, say, Virginia right. by itself, what does it reflect versus the 2.5? Is it 2.5? Is it 1.0? Is it,
right.
I think it would be a good way to reflect it in terms of what people are seeing. Because I think you're right, it's what you, my reason for asking is exactly as you said, you're reflecting the collective whole
right.
of the metro system and that is what we're serving.
Right.
A regional system, and it's different from jurisdiction.
But we will give you some more definitive information on it.
Any further questions? Jerry?
Thank you very much. The, there are two issues that I raised the last time, and if you have already covered these in detail, tell me and I won't pursue them. But the first was, and I see you're responsive to this, is the number of officers who are assigned administrative functions. Are you presently reviewing this to see whether all 30 of these individuals need to be doing this, or whether we couldn't civilianize, if that's a verb?
That's an effort that we are definitely paying close attention to. It's my intention to make sure that the badge and the gun is out on the street doing the jobs of law enforcement, making arrests, things of that nature. There are some specific functions that are necessary as far as law enforcement, but those other civilian positions, we are trying to civilianize those in the area of record keeping, communication dispatchers, crime analysts. So we are pulling out the police officer and making sure that we put in a person who has the same capabilities but isn't necessarily a sworn officer.
How many officers do you have available for less than full-time duty who might be, this might be relevant to this question, who are not able to, for one reason or another, stress, disability, whatever it is, who might be available for this line of work?
I can give you the exact numbers, but I would think that we average maybe about six officers that are on some type of limited duty.
Limited duty.
And we take advantage of those officers the same way as that we take advantage of some of the Metro employees who are out on limited duty. We use them to become the eyes and ears in assisting the auto theft units to go out to the various parking locations. If they see people who are doing something suspicious, they can communicate that information to law enforcement and we can come in and make the arrest. We also have other functions that they can assist us while they're in that limited duty capacity.
The second issue concerns the ability to speak Spanish, which I raised the last time. And you now report that there are but 20 members of the force who are bilingual. By bilingual, you mean they speak Spanish, or
yes.
Is this Vietnamese?
No, they speak Spanish.
Korean, Mandarin, Chinese.
Speak Spanish.
And just Spanish.
Yes.
Referring to. Well, you ought to
I
say
can give you the
bilingual in Spanish, because there are different kinds of bilingual. But only 20 of 450. What's that? What's the percentage of that? Less than 5%, which I would suspect is of certainly of concern to me and the District of Columbia. I suspect it's a concern to other jurisdictions that we have such limited capacity. Of the new 13 recruits, how many of these individuals speak Spanish?
That I will be able to tell you later on today. I'll give you that specific information.
What efforts are being made with the remaining 15 vacancies to recruit Spanish-speaking officers?
Well, we've
for other bilingual capacities.
Yes. We have engaged in a very aggressive effort. We've been doing a lot of recruiting at John Jay College. One, we get the person that's qualified, and in the New York metropolitan area, there are a considerable number of Spanish-speaking bilingual people that we would want to be seeking out. One of our recruiters is Spanish-speaking, and so he makes a concerted effort to sort of engage those members of the Spanish-speaking to come on to the department.
You have Spanish-speaking people in this metropolitan area, too.
True.
Are you making efforts in this area?
Yes, we are. We make efforts in this area. What we have found, however, is that when you're looking for the qualified best applicant that can pass our entrance exam, that can finish the 6-7 months of training, when we get someone from a criminal justice institution, we're in a better position to ensure that that person finishes the training academy.
So you're talking now about lateral hires?
No, we're not, no.
What do you mean a criminal justice institution?
John Jay College specializes in criminal justice.
Yeah, okay. So What specific things are you doing in this area to recruit?
We're doing the internet. We have online registration. We're doing job fairs. We just recently participated in a job fair. So we're aggressively recruiting. We aren't doing that much recruiting at military installations because of the war, and we haven't been that successful in bringing military people here. The ones that we have, we usually lose them to deployment, and so we have about four officers that are called back to do service military.
Well, Chief, we appreciate all of the fine work you're doing, but, you know, I think it would be a great shame if we hired 28 new officers and had none who had this capability. Or, you know, I mean, I'd like to see, I don't know how others feel, you can speak out if you agree or disagree, but we'd like to see a significant number of the remaining 15.
I will give you that breakdown. I'm not saying that we don't have Spanish-speaking members that are already in this group of 13.
Right, that's right. That's right. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Two questions. First, to follow up on Mr. Graham's. Mr. Cato, does NECTRO have any kind of pay for employees who can be certified as speaking other languages?
We're provided training for individuals, but in our labor agreements, I'm not aware of any special pay for bilingual employees. I think the comments made by Director Graham are absolutely correct. We need to be very aggressive going out and seeking individuals. Of course, one of the things that we're competing with is 31 other police departments in this region who are seeking the same individuals. And so we will make that effort. I'm committed to it, and I know the chief is committed to it.
I appreciate that, and I also appreciate the difficulties of recruiting in an environment with all these different police departments, all very highly professional, and being responsible for another one, I know how that is, and you can lose them to federal agencies and everywhere else. But not only for police, but I'm thinking about throughout the organization, there's a need here, as there is elsewhere, for people with a language capability, and just by percentages, one language happens to be the one that is widely spoken. We have in my county like 100 different languages spoken, but after English, only one of them is over 5%. The next ones are many and scattered, but we have a large number of Spanish speakers. And our county did a few years ago institute a measure that allows for people who work for the county to qualify and receive a bonus in pay. And then, they have to obviously be certified that they are fluent, and then they bless you. And then they have to agree that they help in certain ways when you need people. If you're the one in the office who's getting that, then you're going to have to help deal with those customers who come in and so on. In any event, I would suggest it's something you might want to take a look at as one possible way to deal with the difficulty of recruiting people with the talent you're looking for who also have this additional qualification. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask a question on the crime statistics.
Continue.
The statistics are broken down a number of different ways here. Geographically, in the broad sense of what jurisdiction the stations are in, by category of Part 1 crimes and so on. It's harder to get a sense, though, of the geography on kind of a more micro level. When you look at a table like the one on page 32 in our presentation, and you see top Metro Rail stations ranked by crime. So we have crimes associated with a particular station. I'm not sure what that conjures up to people, in people's minds, but I suspect that it may be different than what I think I know the reality to be. The stations that have high levels are almost uniformly stations that have large parking facilities. And I'm willing to bet that most of those crimes are actually things that are taking place associated with the parking facility. I imagine there are very few crimes, in fact, that occur within the station. Now, if you take a station that is in a more urban setting and doesn't have, parking associated with it, then the only metro property really is the station and the immediately adjacent area. And I assume you're not capturing stuff going on outside of our property.
No.
As is entirely appropriate. On the other hand, I think it may be a little confusing to people to understand what's really going on. The larger message here that I think you tried to make the point is, if you are familiar at all with crime statistics, the level of crime is exceedingly low on metro property in any form.
That's right.
And there are these pockets that kind of jump out. Still, for the number of people going to these stations, it's actually a low rate, which is not to say it's acceptable to anybody, but we need to understand the nature of it. And I would like to see if there's some way to break this down that shows you kind of where, you know, how many of these are crimes occurring in a parking lot versus how many of them are occurring, you know, more associated with the station. They clearly call for different types of remedy. It's a different type of situation. And, you know, if you, there are many operators of large parking facilities. I mean, after all, there are 8 parking spaces for every car in America. And I think we've seen recently the statistics on parking in Tyson's, which is, you know, there's more square footage in the parking than in the office or something like that. So we have all these parking facilities out there, and all the big retail operators, you know, malls and suburban shopping centers are full of huge parking lots. They don't hold public meetings to discuss the crime in their lots. But if you could get that data, I think you would find that there is an extraordinary amount, for most people, of crime that takes place in those. It is the nature of that type of facility. I suspect that there is more, I can't prove it, but I suspect there is more that goes on actually in private lots than in ours. But certainly, from what I know from other work I do and where crimes occur, you know, crime in parking lots is a problem. So, you know, none of this is to minimize that, you know, we don't find any level of crime. We want zeros on all those things. But we do need to understand the nature we're talking about. And it is important people understand we're talking about basically an extremely low level of crime, and one that that seems to be that if there's a nagging problem, it's what you do about large parking facilities. And I think it's what we share with other operators of such facilities, public and private. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman.
Sorry, it provoked a continuation there, because that goes back to the question about what we say jurisdictionally about what level of crime is Part 1, but I think it might be even better to point out which of Part 1 crimes are the highest and what they actually reflect for the community, because I think what Mr. Zimmerman is saying is it is breaking into the car and taking out the GPS piece versus when the community hears it, they have the distinct view that it's unsafe for persons, not just property. So, and particular property.
So would it be advantageous the next time we give presentations to separate those stations that have parking facilities, identify those parking-related crimes, and then do a separate list of any and other types of crime, whether we've categorized them by robberies, things not associated with the parking lot.
Some Hewlett?
Chief, do you happen to know offhand, I mean, you may not know the exact statistics, but do you happen to know offhand if a large chunk of it is parking lot related?
Oh, I know for a fact.
So you definitely know. Okay. So,
that would be a property.
Okay, because I'm looking, you know, obviously I'm seeing an issue here. And granted, as Mr. Zimmerman said, that this may be a common problem with all parking lot operations, including the private ones, and still Metro is very, very safe, relatively speaking. I'm still looking at under the Maryland and Prince George's County at 9 of the 10. That's a major major problem, and I'd like to have it broken down as well, so I can see what that issue is and what we can do also.
No further questions. I think the point here is it's clear that our statistics continue to reflect that we have a very low percentage of crime, and I think the message here among the members is that I think if we can extract data that takes out the parking garages particularly, that it also helps with the perception so people clearly understand where that activity is taking place. And that even though small numbers are even smaller, if you put that in that context. Chairman.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that comment at all, but I do want to add, because of several incidents that are fresh in my mind, that we have had problems with assaults within the cars, in the stations, and I'm willing to emphasize that it's tiny compared to crime elsewhere. But it's still a real problem. And as recently as the ballet presentation that happened at the National Stadium, you know, the reports of kids, you know, taking over cars and terrorizing people. And you know, that underscores for me that side of this problem and the need to have police presence or some kind of security presence of some kind in the stations. Now, in New York, everyone knows you can walk through the whole train. We can't walk through our trains, it seems. But the fact of the matter is that when our customers, when our riders are concerned about this level of violence or threatened potential violence, you know, it's a big issue. It's a big issue. And just with the fresh in mind, several reports which I've shared with the general manager and with the chief that have come to me, you know, I think I want to just say that as a counterweight to be considered as well.
Thank you. I think that point's well taken. I think the chief stated that earlier, that any crime is a crime of serious matter, and his goal is always to eliminate all of it. And you know, and so I think he mentioned that early on. With that, and no further questions, chief, and thank you for your presentation. I will take on one other action. I will ask that we go back to our action item. Now that we have everybody here, and we'll take that on, and let's return to the action item. Authorize public hearings to discontinue non-regional metro bus routes 2W, 12A/S, and 20F/Y in Fairfax County.
Can somebody move approval?
I, Mr. Chairman, I move a recommendation to discontinue the non-regional bus service as stated. And it is to authorize the hearing, sorry.
I'll second the motion.
It's been properly moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
The ayes have it, and the motion carries. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you very much, Mr. Linton. I'm sorry I was late. I had some urgent dental needs, which I don't want to remember at the moment. So who is, we're now on back to information items. And we have the impact of the transfer of DC Medicaid transportation services to Metro Access.
Safety and performance.
You haven't done safety? Go ahead. Okay, all right, back to safety.
Well, I can skip that if you know.
I'm sorry, I thought you had covered that. No.
Thank you very much. I just want to remind everybody before I begin that here that October is considered Fire Safety Awareness Month. And although the daylight saving time has been pushed back to the first weekend in November now, it used to be in October, but when you go to change your clocks, that's always a good time to change the batteries in your smoke detectors. And I know a lot of regulations now require that smoke detectors be hardwired, but also there's a battery backup in those hardwired devices, and you still want to change those batteries on a regular basis. Okay, beginning with the statistics for July rail safety performance indicators. The rail passenger injuries for on board reduced this month for 7. We had a reduction for the rail transit facility occupant injuries of 4. And our rail passenger injury rate has gone down. Escalator injuries that were reduced by 8. There were no rail collisions, no derailments. And the fire incidents were reduced by 3, and smoke incidents were increased by 1. I was told that there was a question last month about the severity of injuries to passengers. The numbers that are reflected here are those people who are immediately transported from the scene to some sort of medical facility. As far as the extent of the injuries after that, we don't really track that unless that's a fatality or something like that, but we can go back and start looking at those type of injuries and that severity level. For August, you can see rail passenger injuries were reduced by 13. The rail facility injuries were reduced by 12. And again, we had a reduction in the rail passenger injury rate. Escalator injuries were the same. There were no collisions, no derailments there. Fire incidents and smoke incidents were reduced.
Okay.
For bus, we had no reduction in the passenger injuries, but the preventable bus collision rate was reduced, and the non-preventable bus accident collision rate was also reduced. So our bus passenger injury rate was slightly down. For August, you can see there was just a single drop in passenger injuries for the bus, but the rates for preventable and non-preventable, well, the rates for preventable are down, but the rates for non-preventable went up slightly, and the bus passenger injury rate was also reduced for the month of August. For Metro Access, we had a slight increase in the Metro Access passenger injuries, but the Metro Access collisions were reduced by 7, and the collision rate's down, and the injury rate is up slightly. That was for the month of July, and for the month of August, the same thing. We had a reduction in the Metro Access passenger injuries of 4. You can see that the Metro Access collisions went up, and that the Metro Access collision rate for the month of August went up slightly, but the Metro Access passenger injury rate went down. So overall, we're showing a reduction in our passenger injuries on board and in the stations. Any questions?
Well, that's a very positive report for us. You know, we're still kind of fine-tuning these reports.
Yes, sir.
I don't know whether it's appropriate to go into more recent events or not, but I would suggest a year-to-date number as well.
Yes, I will provide it.
A year-to-date comparison number.
Yes, sir.
Although what you have given us is useful. Are there questions or comments on safety? I think we're going to be discussing this a little bit more once we focus
yes, sir.
On more recent events.
Okay.
But this is a good report for these months. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Now we proceed to what I said before, which is the impact of the transfer of DC Medicaid transportation services to Metro Access. This was an item that was particularly requested by several members, me included, and so we want to hear what the background is on this.
Good morning, and thank you. Before I begin the presentation, I would like to just inform the committee that since we had raised this issue last month, we did have a very productive meeting with district staff yesterday to include city council staff and staff representing the Department of Transportation, the Department of Health, and representation from the executive office of the mayor. So we had a very positive discussion on this issue, so we're pleased to report that. So really the purpose of the rest of the presentation is just to give you a sense of the salient policy and cost impact issues that this matter represents. First, I'd like to show you a comparison of what DC Medicaid transportation system does as compared with Metro Access ADA paratransit. And as you can see from this slide, there is a reimbursement mechanism for the Medicaid transportation system that Metro Access does not have. The recent door-to-door service change that we implemented from curb-to-curb service is also a distinction from the Medicaid service, which is door-through-door. Customers in a door-through-door service are taken to their ultimate destination, which could be inside a doctor's office or on a higher floor of an apartment building or what have you. There is a cost differential between the two services, and I did have some questions asked of me about why it's so different. And the big difference between these is that we in Metro Access have to accommodate all requests for travel, regardless of trip purpose, nearly 24 hours a day throughout the entire region, whereas the other system can have a smaller infrastructure because travel is specifically limited to trips with a medical purpose and the corresponding hours that would be implied. Also, the ADA paratransit service is designed to accommodate the ADA definition of a mobility device or a standard wheelchair. The Medicaid transportation service accommodates non-standard chairs and also even people who travel in stretchers or other devices where there's an obvious non-emergency medical need that Metro Access is not equipped to handle. The Medicaid system right now is operating approximately 50,000 van trips a month, and that includes accessible vans as well as non-accessible vans. So there are some ambulatory passengers that are being accommodated by that service, whereas Metro Access is peaking at 140,000 trips a month, and as you all know, this is a 16% increase from the previous year, and the actuarial study that we did shows that that trend is expected to continue over the next 5 years. The reason why we felt the need to bring this issue up so quickly is because of the quick turn of events that's happened on this activity, and really a lot of the reason for it is economic, that the cost of both programs has been rising rapidly, and as the district began to explore alternatives, best, you know, lower cost, more cost effective alternatives to their current program, there were some actions that were taken that had an immediate impact on Metro Access that started with our own contractor being approached to be a potential provider of this service. And of course, our own contractor's quite busy accommodating the volume that Metro Access has. And then, of course, also, while Metro is fully willing to assist with travel training and helping people to use bus and rail, the numbers of customers we're talking about is pretty high, and certainly more so than our agency alone could accommodate with our travel training program. And then finally, and this really I think was probably one of the most disturbing of the events, was that customers who are using the Medicaid system right now were approached and told that their transportation benefits were going to imminently stop, and that they were being asked to apply for Metro Access in large volumes. And this number has now reached 1,164 applications that have been received by our eligibility certification office. Obviously, this represents an impact to us both operationally and from a financial standpoint. But operationally, I just want to point out again the increase in ridership, and the fact what this implies is not just additional operating cost to add the volume, but also when we pass certain thresholds of growth, it requires us to revisit the infrastructure as well as our fleet plan. And so those are additional costs beyond the per trip rate that we were discussing earlier. And also, again, since the year 2000, Metro Access has been a zero denial service. Again, we don't turn anyone away for any reason, and that's the mantra that Metro Access has been following. So it's not that Metro has an option to not accommodate the trips once customers have been deemed eligible and are issued their ID card. And again, you know, we can move on past that. The eligibility certification process would apply to each one of those individuals. I wanted to just quickly highlight again, I did mention that there are some different aspects to Medicaid transportation service that the ADA paratransit system would not be able to accommodate in our current model. And I've already described the difference in the types of mobility devices that might be required, but also here, and you see there's a picture, an example there of a chair, that this device actually has the ability to convert from a stretcher type device back to a chair. And there are other non-emergency medical needs that might be implied, whether it's oxygen and or just even having someone stay on the vehicle and attend to their medical, behavioral, or other needs while they're traveling, which Metro Access is not configured to provide. And then the final piece, we really didn't talk about this much, but even though there is a reimbursement mechanism from the federal Medicaid program, the administrative requirements to get that reimbursement are fairly burdensome. I think the district would agree that that's something that no one is particularly eager to embrace. And Metro is certainly not staffed to do that. But then when we get to the cost impacts, you know, I round the number to 1,000 customers, that the impact to the operating budget alone could be as much as $4.3 million, not including the infrastructure and fleet implications that I mentioned previously to handle that additional volume. So the final recommendation from this presentation is really that what we want to do is to really leverage the bus and rail system and to do everything that we can to help the Medicaid customers who are capable of using bus and rail to make that transition. And staff here are more than willing to do that. We've already had some dialogue on this subject. But I think until we can gauge the impact of the volume and issues that unfortunately would adversely affect the customer if they started to try to use Metro Access and discovered that we weren't able to accommodate their needs, it would really be better if we put a hold on that and worked through a comparison of the two services and tried to find a more ideal mix of where the passengers would best be served between our two organizations.
Thank you. Are you finished?
Yes, I am.
Thank you very much. Let me at the outset say that this issue coming before the committee and before the board focused my attention on this issue as well. And let me make just a couple of basic points. First, it is definitely in the district's interest to have these costs remain as a reimbursable under Medicaid. And what happened here, I am advised, is that our Medicaid contractor, as a result of a poor management decision, you know, issued a statement encouraging people to switch to Metro Access. And it is not in our interest to do this. You know, it's certainly not in the interest of Metro Access to assume these additional rides and transportation responsibilities. And so what I have done is we have established a working group within the council, including staff from DDOT and WMATA, the Department of Health, and the council itself, to remedy these problems on a very swift basis, because we want these folks to come back to a reimbursable program, and we are upset that this has happened to the extent that it has happened. And clearly there is a bump here in Metro Access demand, which can be traced directly to this contractor instruction that was sent out. And so I'm hopeful that we can have a fix on this within 30 days. And prior to taking any action, this is not an action item. I wouldn't like to take any action until we can get this fixed within the District of Columbia, if that's possible. Mr. Linton.
Mr. Chairman, I'm in some regard, I'm glad to hear that there's been an effort to try to take some corrective action here. But I am curious as to how, in fact, this occurred, and how a contractor was able to communicate this to clients. And according to your statement, it seems to suggest without authorization or approval that was in fact done. Was there written communication? Were there flyers? Or how was it? Any idea on how this communication was delivered to clients?
There were letters were issued to some clients.
The letters were mailed or issued to clients and provided by the contractor.
Yes. But my understanding, though, is, and even in the course of our discussions, that another letter was issued to retract the previous statement and to begin to remedy the situation. So I think there's been an effort to resolve that part.
What's the status of the contractor's contract at this point? Any idea?
We don't know that, but we can find that out for you.
In terms of what they're doing, or
no, I was wondering what's the status of the contract with the contractor, I do know that, you know, if we in fact had similar situations with our contractor, that there would be efforts by this board to intervene, and we would be all over them. That's generally how we responded. We've had these situations with our own paratransit service, so I was just curious as to. What's the duration of the contract? Where's the district at within that contract? What are the remedies for this type of behavior? Because not only is it putting demands on our system, but more importantly, you're trashing the lives of individuals who, in fact, don't need an additional burdens, who are being yanked back and forth with some very, very medically needed services. I think that is... that's very serious, the fact that, you know, this occurred, I would love to hear and get some information on what the remedies are and how that contractor has actually been handled. So if we can get that information back, I would greatly appreciate it.
Is there a further discussion?
No, sir.
There was one thing in your presentation, however, that perked my interest. And that is that on page 51, you say the process for seeking reimbursement from federal Medicaid program is administratively burdensome and would require additional staff and resources. But that suggests to me that Metro Access could be seeking federal reimbursement?
No. The only reason why that's in there is because when we were asked to take on the customer volume, there was no discussion of movement of that money from the Department of Health to the people who would be receiving the responsibility of providing the service.
So you would, what you're talking about here is some kind of transfer of the federal funding, even though there was no federal service being provided to Wamaka?
Can I, Mr. Chairman, if I, because I raised a question when this came up before. What I was suggesting, I was asking the question as to, there is federal funds that's provided for this service, and those federal funds were provided to D.C. I asked the question at the last time this issue came up, what efforts were made to make sure that the federal funds, and I was under the impression that the program had been terminated, and we were in a position where we were going to carry the burden of the service. So I asked what actually provisions were put in place so that those federal funds that were going to the district would follow those clients when they came to Metro if we were providing the service. And I think the response of the staff was, if we were conducting that service, the challenge of getting those federal dollars would be very difficult and require
interest. I understand that, but I'm raising a separate question, which is, if Metro Access provides services which are eligible for reimbursement under Medicaid, we could be seeking that reimbursement for Medicaid generally.
I suppose it's possible. It's not a one-to-one reimbursement.
No. DC, I think it's 70%. Mm-hmm. But the basic question, do you understand, this is a different question, is that putting this situation aside, because I think we're going to fix this situation, putting this situation aside, are there services within Metro Access which may be eligible for Medicaid reimbursement?
I do not believe that they are, but I will, again, look at all the regulations from the Medicaid standpoint, Medicare standpoint, and the FTA to determine that.
Can we just finish his thoughts?
Yeah. And that was it. We will.
Are you finished?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Zimmer.
I took the import of this statement to be that if Metro has to do this, it's going to take more money, which means us.
Yes.
That, you know, they can't take this on and, and process it all without us all somehow paying more.
No, that's understood. I'm asking a separate
question.
This is a separate question, which had not heretofore entered my mind, but it is now in my mind, is whether or not there are eligible Metro Access services in terms of Medicaid reimbursement. And I would just, the answer to that might be clearly no. I just don't know, but I'd like to know. Is that okay?
Yes.
Can we have that next time?
Can I help you with that answer?
Yeah, if you know it.
Well, I know something about it. For the last, I guess our new staffer can probably help me with that, but I probably for about the last at least 10 years, and maybe even longer, there has been a coordinating council group between HHS and DOT trying to find out ways in which HHS money could in fact be used for transportation that's provided by public transit agencies. There's been various efforts to try to offer our services to Medicaid recipients, and the objective at that point has been trying to get those who are using medical service to use fixed systems so that the government could actually save money. I don't think there is actually a movement that allows of tracking of those recipients to public transit and then seeking reimbursement from HHS. I don't think there's actually an opportunity there or anything that exists that allows that to effectively happen. But it's a good question to raise, and there is a HHS DOT Coordinating Council that meets on this issue all the time. That's probably where the question needs to be asked and where the answer needs to come from, not just DOT, but that coordinating council is a place where I think that would occur.
Well, let me just add that I think it is a good question. I rather liked it. And now I'm told that DDOT, 50 transit agencies surveyed by APTA, 4 were able to get these reimbursements. So something is happening here. And, you know, as we see our exploding metro access budget, you know, I mean, if this is in any way possible or feasible, you know, I'd like to know the answer. So do you want to check on this information?
Absolutely, I will. And to reemphasize what Director Linton has said, from my experience, I'm not aware of the abilities to do it, but obviously there are 4 systems somewhere in the United States that can do that. So we will look at that to determine if that's possible.
All right, let's go on because we're allocated. Do we have 20 more minutes? Or if we need it. If we need it. Pardon? Well, okay, because I know we're scheduled today. Paper transfers is the next issue.
Thank you. Sir Wilson will make that presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today we're talking about our communications effort with regard to the elimination of paper transfers. As you know, in January, the board took action to eliminate paper transfers effective January of 2009. That means the elimination of both rail transfers, rail paper transfers, as well as bus paper transfers.
Mr. Chairman, are you taking questions now, or do you want to wait until the end?
What's your pleasure? You should just have like one just sentence. Do you want to have a question?
Yeah, I have a question on that one sentence.
Okay. how long? Everyone's very anxious to talk about this. So how long is your presentation?
My presentation's about 10 minutes. I can make it as shorter as
Do you want to give her a 5 minutes uninterrupted and then
sure.
You can just
the high points here. The board took action to eliminate bus and rail paper transfers, and given that, staff has been very active over the past few months to execute the board's direction here, including ceasing our orders of a bus transfers, letting our contract lapse, all these sorts of things happening behind the scenes. The key to the success of the elimination of paper transfers is going to be communication. We've done a ton of community outreach already, and I've met with the JCC, the Riders Advisory Council, and several of the local transit operators groups. We'll be doing a marketing blitz starting in the next couple of weeks. You'll see lots of advertising on bus, on rail, in brochures, on our web. We'll be doing lots of things in multiple languages. Most of our messaging will be in Spanish and in English. We're also developing a podcast in 7 languages: Spanish, Korean, Vietnamese, Chinese, French, Arabic, and Amharic. We have some, and those audio messages will be available to social service agencies and to other groups who deal specifically with those non-English speaking populations. There are benefits to the customer with this. Smart Trip is cheaper. You save 10 cents off each ride if you use a Smart Trip card. And frankly, the Smart Trip card will pay for itself within 2.5 weeks if you usually have round trips and use a transfer. So after 50 trips, your card will pay for itself. In addition, the board directed us to extend the transfer time from 2 hours to 3 hours, so that's another benefit to the customer. Customers can purchase Smart Trip cards currently at 85 locations. We're also working with some of the local retailers to expand that reach. In addition, there are 2,800 locations, including all of the local bus, all of our metro buses, all of the local buses, and a number of sales offices and commuter stores in the region where customers can load on value. It's important to remember that even though the paper transfers are going away, electronic transfers will still be available on Smart Trip cards, and our passes will still be sold. Now, for $11, you can either get 3 gallons of gasoline, or you can get unlimited bus trips for a week on Metrobus. So the weekly bus pass will still be in effect. That's $11, the 7-day short trip pass, and the weekly rail pass. All of these passes will still be available, and in some cases, for some customers, it may be more cost-effective for them to use the pass and to go paying trip by trip. For the benefits to us, we are looking at improving our bus boarding times, minimizing our fraud and abuse, and reducing our assaults on bus operators. We had something even last week with an assault in Maryland with a bus operator who got into a dispute with a customer who got into a dispute with a bus operator over the issue of a transfer. By moving away from paper transfers, we can get away from our 30-plus-year-old machines in our rail stations. It's costly to us. It's $300,000 a year to maintain our orders of paper transfers. And there is this prospect of enhanced revenue. We've been in contact both with Chicago and Boston, two transit agencies that have successfully eliminated their transfers. Boston recognized $14 million in revenue they had not expected in the year that they eliminated transfers. And Boston has about half the ridership that we do and a little bit lower cost for their bus ride. And Chicago has about double the bus ridership that we do. And they recognize $37 million in the year that they eliminated bus transfers. Some of that they had budgeted for, but about $17 million they hadn't budgeted for. So we could be looking at a revenue enhancement for that. And our next steps, we're going to continue to aggressively reach out to the public, and particularly to those segments of our customer population that are most in need of, or most transit dependent. My community relations director, Jorge Navarez, has been very active reaching out to social service agencies. He and his staff reaching out to social service agencies throughout the region to work with them, to understand their needs, and to work with them on the education of this whole effort here.
Thank you very much. I just want to say, by way of opening to this, that there is an issue regarding tokens and how tokens have been used by social service agencies. And I think everyone on this board has been approached in that regard. And I do want to talk about that. But I am very concerned about how the elimination of paper transfers is going to hit those least able to pay. And when this all was before us last year, this board, I think, was very wise to cause this delayed period for the distribution of free Smart Trip cards. And we do need, I don't see it in this presentation, I'm sorry to say, but we do need an update on that program as to what's happened. The last time we heard about that distribution effort, at least insofar as the District of Columbia, I don't think we had very satisfactory results, which I'm not, that's not blaming Metro necessarily. We're looking at the D.C. agencies, but people who are used to having these paper transfers are all of a sudden going to pay double bus fares. And this is not a source of revenue that I'm interested in having. And so whatever happened in Chicago and Boston is of interest, but I don't want to make money off of poor people who suddenly have to pay twice for the bus trip that they need to make involving two or sometimes three buses. And so there are big issues involved here for that population particularly. And so I think we're getting part of the report here, but not all of it.
May I address the issue of the tokens?
Or the general manager.
Oh, the issue of additional revenues that were collected by Chicago, Boston, Los Angeles, Santa Monica, and other locations were not because people were paying the double fare. What they found was that there was a huge underground selling of transfers. Transfers that people found out of the trash, printed, counterfeited throughout the country. And so that's where the significant increase in revenues came from. It's that large. Last week I was at the Southern Avenue Division talking to operators, and they informed me of situations which were communicated to the transit police where at major terminal points there were individuals with books of transfers selling those transfers to customers for a low price in lieu of them paying the basic fare of getting on the bus. So I want to be clear, any revenue increases we do not see for double fares, and we will do whatever it takes to ensure that people get the Smart Trip cards or any mechanism that we can come up with. This is the amount of monies that we're being cheated out of because of illegal activities.
Okay. Let me just say, others want to talk, but let me just say that you've made an excellent point. But all the same, you're still going to have bus riders who, unless we do the right kind of job here, who are going to end up being stuck with two and three fares on a single trip. And Mr. Benjamin, Ms. Hewlett, Mr. Linton, Okay. Okay, Zimmerman. So Benjamin Hewlett Linton Zimmerman.
I think Mr. Yule.
And Yule, I beg your pardon, Mayor.
I want to clarify the statement that you made right in the beginning. To the best of my knowledge, the board has taken two separate actions at two different times relative to paper transfers. One of those was for bus-to-bus transfers, which we took a year ago when we approved the fare increase. And at that time, we said, you got a year to do it, and it's for bus-to-bus transfers only.
There was also, and it's a little bit difficult to read in the tariff here, too. There was bus-to-bus, and it also says, after one-year transition, rail-to-bus transfers issued on smart cards only. And so it's that one-year transition that...
I'm sorry, you're in the tariff?
I'm in the tariff. This is the tariff, right?
I'm talking about board actions, not what staff did in the tariff.
This is the board action from 2007. Yeah, and I agree. It was a little bit. In fact, a JCC member had come to me this morning saying, "I only see bus to bus." Mm-hmm. So it is, it is part of the tariff. It was part of the board action. It was taken last January.
Okay.
It's
That was that in the table that was attached, or is that
it is? It's in the table that's attached, and it says docket. Can't really read this. Docket B07B, it looks like.
Okay, so it did, in fact, include both.
It did. It doesn't say, unfortunately, it's kind of under that other separate title, but it says, after one-year transition, rail-to-bus transfers issued on smart cards only. And it's that direction on the rail side that we were following, as well as, if you scroll down a little bit more.
I'm sorry, go ahead and tell me where it is. It's under...
So if you look...
Other fees?
No, where it says passes, I'm sorry, it says Metro Rail fares is...
Under passes.
Under passes, the first line there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there's that, and then there's also the bus-to-bus that you mentioned.
Okay, so that was part of our action in December a year ago.
Yes.
All right. And so we are set on a track where we would be doing this now. Now, you said that passes, one of the things that the ROC... RAC talked to us about was the fact that passes when issued for rail would not necessarily allow anybody to go on to bus. Are we prepared to put passes on smart trip cards?
I'm not the smart trip person here, and she's actually meeting with the folks who will be implementing that that transition right now. My understanding from the smart trip office, though, is that the pass, the ability to put passes on smart trip will not come until early 2010.
Okay, so what is our plan for what we'll do for people who are riding rail using a pass and then transfer to a bus?
Well, in that case, there is no solution on smart trip. So the solution for somebody who's got a rail pass is to either do a transaction by transaction, either with cash, or if they need to transfer, use their smart trip card, but it would be $1.35 that they'd have to pay, or $1.25. coming off their smart
card. So you're saying they no longer would get the reduction, which in fact we made part of the board action.
Right. So there's that option. The other thing is, if you're taking more than four round trips in a week on bus, it would be cheaper for you anyway to buy the $11 bus pass, in which case you would have your rail pass and your bus pass. So if you're somebody who commutes, using rail to bus every day, then it's cheaper for you to buy.
Cheaper than if you paid the full fare.
Exactly.
But not cheaper than if you pay the reduced fare with transfers. We're effectively saying anybody who uses one of our rail passes will not be able to stay within what the board passed as the fees that they should be charged for a rail bus trip. Is that right?
Now you're getting into more legal things here. So I'm going
to... No, not a legal thing. You won't be able to do it because you don't have the mechanism to do it a year after we said this is something you have to do.
But I think what the board is saying here is that your $1.35 is or your $1.65 for rail is going to entitle you to a rail trip, and that's it.
But today you can have a rail trip and a bus trip for that, or another 35 cents, you can have a bus.
But after a year, if the board's actions here, after 1 year, that $1.65 will only entitle you to that.
Yeah, I don't think that was the interpretation of the board at the time that they did that.
No, absolutely not.
No. I think that's a revisionist version of the way the board was acting at the time. The board very clearly intended that you would be able to use your smart trip card in order to get the reduction that occurs for any transfer, bus to rail, rail to bus, or bus to bus. And what you're saying now is, no, that's not going to be possible.
If we proceed in the direction that we continue to be proceeding, you're right, yes.
Based upon our interpretations of the fare tariff, that's, you're absolutely right. Yeah. But
and you're in the 2,800 places where you can load value onto your smart trip card, how many of those are buses?
Most of them are buses. And
all except, say, 100 or 200?
A couple of hundred. We're going to be looking at, by November, we're looking at extending the point of sale, the footballs where you can go and load value on. And by the spring, we're looking at another couple hundred. So, you know, by let's say, spring of 2009, then you'd be looking at in excess of 3,100 locations, including half of those being, or more than half of those being bus.
Well, okay. I guess I want to ask the general manager the question of, do you believe that if people need to, whenever they need to, add value to their smart trip cards when getting on buses, that that's going to have a significant effect on boarding times?
It has some impact on boarding times, but we have customers who do that today. I don't recall the percentage of bus passengers who have smart trip cards, it is a transaction that proceeds and occurs on a daily basis in our system, and our operators are very capable of doing it. I think the first time an individual tries, there might be a moment delay. But I just got the note that 66% of our Metro bus riders have smart trip cards, so two-thirds of them have it. But we're talking about the other maximum one-third.
So what you're saying is if they did what the system is set up for,
right,
there are an adequate number of places in for them to load value.
Yes.
And that it would not have an undue effect on the schedules of buses as you see it.
No, given that 66% of our Metro bus riders today
already are doing
already that. Have cards, I do not see a major impact.
By the way, we've got, will you yield to Mr. Zimmerman so
certainly
he can?
And on this point, because first, I have to say that I've never heard a number as high as two-thirds before just now for bus riders. It's lagged way behind. If we're up to 66%, that's a great accomplishment. But I wonder if we ask the question, what percentage of people boarding buses are using Smart Trip? If you would give me the same number.
No, it would not be.
You'd give a much lower number, not half of the riders.
Yesterday, in fact, we did do a survey in the District of Columbia, and the use of Smart Trip cards on the bus was 29%.
Yeah, that's my thought. So, now, let me point out that, and this is the only reason I interrupted here, the difficulty of the transition here is that a disproportionate number of those who are using Smart Trip on bus are rail riders. They're therefore able to load value at the rail station,
that's
and
right.
They're used to doing that. In fact, many of them are probably getting it automatically because they're people who have, you know, the employment benefits and all that. What we're talking about is transitioning the large portion of riders who don't have any of that. They don't have smart trip cards now. They're not rail users. So if they're solely bus users, they're going to have this problem of where do I do it? Which means that you don't just have a small increase of the number of people trying to do that transaction as they board the bus. You have a huge increase in that. And then instead of speeding up boarding time, as smart trips should be able to do, and one of the reasons we want to do this move, it will wind up slowing things down because we actually have very few places that any of them can reach where they can load value onto their cards. I think that's the fundamental problem. Thank you.
And I think that goes back to the question that we asked you, and maybe you want to go back, think about it, and come back to us again with, do you truly believe that you'll be able to do this with no significant impact upon the bus schedules if the boarding time were to change to do this? I guess the other statistic that's useful in looking at the question of, clearly, you're not going to be able to accommodate people who are using rail passes of various sorts at any time in the near future. How many people do actually use these rail passes? What percentage of our ridership are we talking about?
I don't have the rail pass information. We can get that to you.
That would be helpful. I mean, if we're affecting a substantial number of people, this looks like a major problem for us. If we're not really getting very many people using these passes, that may be a different issue. So we need to know what we're dealing with here.
I will do the work that you asked concerning the transaction. But what happens today with people without a smart trip card is that there is a transaction on a daily, every time they get on the bus. They have to enter money into the fare box, sometimes bills, sometimes just purely coins. And that is, that takes time. The Smart Trip card, statistically, they would not load or put money into the fare box as often. And when you average that out, the logic of that, you will, in my judgment, not only match today's time for boarding, but lower that time. But we can do some analysis and statistics on that. It is not that difficult to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Hewlett.
Thank you. I wanted to get back to your statement about generating revenue in this fashion. And I think that change is very, very difficult. I think that it's for all of us, and we're used to doing things a certain way. And I think I remember how hard it was for me to learn how to use the computer and the BlackBerry and the microwave and all those different things. And it's very, very, and VCR is very, very hard for us to get out of our comfort zones. I think, but I think based on what we were hearing in terms of the money raised in Boston and Chicago, and you said Los Angeles and Santa Monica, there is a lot of revenue to be raised here, but the key is in this marketing blitz, as you mentioned. And I think we have to use every single means at our disposal to make sure that we get the word out. I looked at everything you had listed here, and I don't even know if there are even more opportunities. So that should minimize the kind of delays that we've been talking about here to some extent. I think it's an imperative that the more we get the word out, the more we do that marketing blitz, the more the less problem we will have, and that we can go forward with this implementation. And I think the benefit in terms of eliminating the fraud, I didn't even realize, you know, I heard about people picking things out of the trash or picking things off the floor, but in terms of the counterfeiting, that's another issue as well. So I think in terms of, I think as long as we really, really do extensive outreach and try to have as many places available, even outside of rail, to get so where people can load the cards, would be very, very helpful. But I do think I think this is what we asked for. This is what we talked about a year ago. I think that we have to move in that direction. By making it as easy as possible for everyone to make that transition.
Madam Chair.
Sorry.
Ms. Fisher-Linton.
One of the questions I had, you cited the savings that was accrued in Chicago CTA. Was that solely due to the elimination of paper transfers? I do know that they also transitioned from paper to plastic, and they also got a bump in revenues as a result of the transition from paper passes, from paper to plastic. Was it solely transfers that generate this revenues?
I don't think Chicago is prepared to say that, and I wouldn't. I don't think that's no. I think the answer is no. What Chicago had anticipated, I think the important point to take out is that Chicago, right, as you say, made that transition from...
It's not solely that. Or do you know?
I don't know. But what I can tell you is that Chicago had budgeted for $19 million as a result of taking actions in this particular year. In the year that they had done it, it was, you know, the switch from paper to plastic. And they had, I think they had also... done a fare increase on some of their rail. And so they had budgeted $19 million for that. They ended up with 36. So they had $17 million in revenue that they had not anticipated, and I think I had brought that up here.
What year was that?
That was in 2007.
I know I did a, in my life as a consultant, I did a peer review of Chicago, and I was looking at fare systems. And I noted at one point there was an increase in revenues, but it wasn't solely related to the transfers. It was also related to slippage that they received as a result of going from paper to plastic. So I want to make sure that we've isolated the savings directly related to transfers solely.
And that's
make sure that we were not including any other factors such as fare increases or transitioning to new routes, increase in service, or also things such as going from paper to plastic.
Right, and that's why we were careful not to make that explicit statement, because we don't have that. We have also not presented you with a revenue number here, because we just don't know. What can we tell you? We can tell you, you know, that we arrested somebody this morning, apparently, according to the chief, for this.
I just think it's important for the board to know that when you look at the numbers, that it may not be precise solely related to transfers. So I want to make sure that we were aware of that.
But we can look at Boston, too. Boston didn't raise their fares on bus, and they've got half the bus ridership that we do, and yet they recognized $14 million in the year that they eliminated paper transfers.
Okay. Mayor,
yes, I agree with the comments already made, particularly Mr. Zimmerman, with regards to the possibility that these smart cards to load on the buses will probably slow the process down. I guess from my analysis of all this, this really comes down to, and marketing way is something that we really need to do much more of, if possible. But if for some reason this seems to me to come down to purchase versus loading. And it appears that we probably need to find ways to make available more outlets in the distribution of the smart cards first and foremost, to get them widely in the hands of our ridership. I think when we do that, then the issue of the paper transfer, doing away with the paper transfers, will resolve itself. But until we get to wider distribution, I just think it's going to, you know, we're going to continue to have these problems. And, you know, we can either choose to postpone until we get more outlets. We can set up some temporary locations to make these cards more readily accessible and available. We can accelerate the process rather than the timetable that staff has outlined here. I really don't see how we're going to be successful at what we're attempting to do here, and to do it by the January 2009 date without creating a lot of chaos. So those are my points that I'd like to offer up.
Thank you. Now, Zimmerman was next, and then we should let Ms. Hutchinson speak, and then back to you second round. Yeah, Zimmerman and Hutchinson.
First, let me ask a question. Wilson, in your presentation, you talked about the time or number of trips it would take for someone to make up the difference by going to Smart Trip. Is that based on the dime difference in the fare solely?
Yes.
Not based on a transfer difference. Okay. It seems to me there are four things in particular that we need to be comfortable about in order to be comfortable with moving forward with it. I think everyone probably fully appreciates that this move ultimately is what we need to do. It's been something the board has been saying for a long time. We wanted to be doing this years ago, frankly. We understand there are all kinds of benefits to moving to Smart Trip. Whether or not, you know, there's enough fraud that we're really going to make a lot more revenue, we don't know. But we will have a better functioning system if everybody's getting on and off by using Smart Trip. The bus will move faster. I mean, those of us who ride the buses know that one of the bigger problems with buses is you lose seconds at every stop when you slow the bus down. That's a problem. That's one of the biggest differences between bus and rail. It's not just the traffic you're in, the fact that you're not moving as fast as traffic because it takes so long to get people on and off. That is the biggest benefit that everyone will get if everyone uses Smart Trip. But there are other benefits as well. For one thing, we'll know how many people are riding the buses, because we don't have accurate information on that now, and that's a problem. We'll have much more accurate information if everybody, including those using special passes and all, are using the same electronic device that's registering appropriately. But in order for it to happen, there's several things. The first one, I'd say, is the point that I made earlier, which is if we depend on loading and unloading passengers to be doing this transaction, loading value under their cards, I don't think this is going to work very well at all. I think it's just going to have the exact opposite effect, which means that we have to be ready with locations all around the region for people to load value under their cards. It's not just purchasing the card, which is a smaller problem. It's being able to put value onto them. And I don't think that there are 2,800 locations. I think that that's not a good way to show the number. Actually, I don't even know how you get to 20. 1,500 of those are Metro buses, presumably, right? So there's still 1,300 I don't know about, because I think there's only about 100 locations. But apart from Metro buses, where do the next 1,300 come from?
Local buses.
Yeah, local buses. So you have Arlington Transit, Q, Fairfax Connector, Dash, Circulator, Loudoun, Ride-On, PRTC. We have the commuter stores.
It is the other bus fleets.
Okay. Well, and the commuter stores in Arlington and Fairfax.
Hold on now. Okay, so take away the buses, and you're down to about 100 locations?
But you're down to places that have major bus transfer points, things like Pentagon, Silver Spring.
There are some good ones. I agree, Pentagon's a good one. It also happens to be a rail station, and most people there are going to rail anyway. So it doesn't necessarily capture. But, for instance, can you do it at Ballston without going into the rail station? Can you do it at the Shirlington Transit Center? Well, yes you can, because we have a commuter store there, so Arlington will make it possible.
Can you do it at Pentagon without going?
But it's still a small... I saw the list a week or so ago, and it is a small number of locations right now.
It is, but it is growing. We have another almost 28 scheduled by the end of November, and another 250 by the spring of 2009. So within the next few months...
28 strikes me as not enough places. 250 starts to get me a lot more interested. But that depends, I think, on the expansion to grocery stores, does it not? Starting to get Giants into this?
It could or could not. I mean, we're in discussions with CVS. We're in discussions with...
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that is the direction. I think once you're into places like CVS's and Giants, you know, then you're taking away a lot of the excuse that people legitimately have that I can't do this. You know, it's part of that. You know, I go do my groceries. It's one more thing I do. You can handle that if you can get into banks. But the point is we need to have places where people are going to go who may never go near a rail station. So that's, you know, I think that's number one. Number two, I was really amazed to hear the answer to Mr. Benjamin's question about the rail-to-bus transfer, because I am pretty certain that no board I've been a part of has ever voted to eliminate the transfer from rail to bus. What we've said more than once and have approved, not just last year but several years ago, was the move to a balanced transfer. We thought that was going to be implemented a long time ago. It turned out it wasn't possible because of other problems we have with this thing. But the whole point was to get balanced transfer so that it's not different when you... I mean, that, again, is something that is a benefit to the customer. The customer can understand. Why does it cost me this in this direction and not this in this direction? It's because we had no way to implement it. You know, we could use the paper transfer one way, not the other way. And the board voted at least 4 years ago to, you know, go to balanced transfer as soon as we could, which we haven't reached yet. I understood when we voted on this thing a year ago, almost a year ago now, that implementation of this meant final implementation of the balance transfer, and I believe we have publicly said so. So,
and much
I think
of us is ready to go.
And that's
ready to go.
I think that's what everybody understands. So, I don't think we should be eliminating paper transfers without simultaneously implementing the balance transfer on rail to bus, bus to rail. Again, I think that's what every member of this board thought they did, and I think the public needs to know when we do this that that's part of what they're getting out of it. And then the third thing I said, more locations. So the last item, it really has to do with marketing. We heard some of the things that are to be done. They all sound good, but I'm not sure they're enough. I think that this is a big change for folks, and we're going to need to make sure we're getting out to people more effectively than we have so far and more effectively than we have in some other cases so that, because, I mean, you know, you put a bunch of notices out, you still have lots of people tell you, I didn't hear anything about this. And, you know, on some level, you never fully get away from that, but you know, you need to do direct marketing to our riders, for instance, at bus stops and shelters. You need to have people who are out there in the field where, you know, this becomes something that is a mission to get the word out to everybody. And you have to be geared up to do that before you implement it. Now, having said all these things, the question is, can you do these by January? And we're not making that decision today, but I think the board is going to have to be comfortable that you're ready to implement these things before we pull the trigger on it. Otherwise, I think we're going to have to consider postponing it. You know, I heard a lot of answers that said, yes, we'll be ready by the spring on that. And you know, my feeling was, I kind of want all those ducks in a row. You know, and again, it's not a today decision, but within the next month or two, clearly you're going to have to make a go, no go. And I believe you need to be able to come to the board and say, here's our way of lineup, here's what we can do, when we can do it. And the board will have to decide.
Will you yield to me just for one
minute? I'm finished.
Because I think Chris has given us a good list, but there's one thing that I want to add to it, and I'm sure you would agree, which is the impact on poor people and the distribution of food. Huh?
Yes, by implication.
Yeah, right. Well, but we don't want to be by implication. We want to expressly state that we need a full report on the success of that, because unless we're having better success than we've had in previous reports, that alone would stop me from going forward with this. But it's Ms. Hutchins on the first one.
I wanted to go back to the distribution of the Smart Trip pieces and the effort that we made then. And my question as we move forward is, have we analyzed the effort made here to see what our benefit is in making sure that that population of people have been impacted already by the balance? I think the concern I have is that where we can least afford the imbalance in the system is where it's being affected. And we made this investment in the beginning, and I would like to see us come back with an analysis of what that investment. We asked, where did the carts go? Did we see a benefit of a better utilization of the cart as a result of doing that? Because I think that's what we're trying to get to, and to remove the other barrier of the increased costs that folks that are least capable of paying would have to bear as we do this. And we're adding complexity to them. And to me, these are the folks that we have least, should be impacting the least in terms of the complexity of how they use the system and the financial benefit to them.
Okay, now we're on second round. Let me just ask one question, if I may, first on second round, is that I'd like to know specifically just how much, to continue your metaphor about pulling the trigger, you know, how many cartridges are in the, you know, the gun at this point. I mean, where are we in terms of making these contracts? Bad one. Well, we talk a lot about gun control.
We have, in July, we placed our final order for paper transfers. On July 14th, we will run out of paper transfers.
July 14th?
I'm sorry, January 14th. We will run on July of 2008, we ran out of. January 14th, we will run out of paper transfers. We have let our contract lapse, so we will need to go set up a whole new contract for the ordering of paper transfers. We've also started discussions with our advertising contractor to talk about the location of the rail transfer machines to possibly turn that into a revenue-generating operation as well. So things that would need to be done, that that issue with the bus, the paper transfers, is a big issue now, and that's done. It's not budgeted. When the bus operations folks set up the budget for this year, they didn't budget for a full year bus transfers. They budgeted for half year bus transfers under the assumption that they wouldn't need any more after January.
So that's an important piece of information for us to have. I mean, we're, it isn't?
Yeah.
No, I think it is, because if we don't do anything, you know, circumstances will overtake us, and this thing will come to an end because there are no paper transfers. Do you have the latest information on the distribution of free Smart Trip cards?
I do. It's two pieces to it. And first, let me tell you what was distributed, given to the social service agencies, how many they have given out, and why the numbers are low. The District of Columbia, we distributed 19,150. Prince George's County, 10,350. Arlington County, 3,450. The City of Alexander, 2,050. Montgomery County, 8,550. Fairfax County, 6,450, for a total of 50,000. Out of that 50,000, collectively, 13,982 have been distributed to individuals or groups. And the balance is 36,018. The major reason for that is, from the perspective of the individuals, these fare cards have no value. They will not have a value in their mind, a true value, until we make this transition in January. So there was not a lot of interest of accepting those fare cards, no value on them. Now, for small value from the standpoint of fares, the big impact will be January, and that's when we anticipate that there will be large number of people seeking the fare cards. I want to agree with something this board has said. We can advertise on every bus, every TV station, every bus stop, every newspaper, and I absolutely guarantee you come the morning that we make this transition, there will be people who do not know about it because they were not paying attention. The experience has been, it generally takes 3 days for people to become aware. After paying the full fare for 3 days, there's a large movement to get this type of instrument in order to not pay the double fare. We will move very aggressively from a marketing standpoint as we move ahead, and I will have discussions with my staff after this meeting about how do we accelerate the number of locations that we can distribute and also upgrade a smart trip card. And if there is an action that I would ask from the board is authorization to distribute additional fare cards is necessary to social service agency if we find in January that the demand is greater than the numbers that we issue. But at any time that we do this, there's going to be a period of learning. And we could put 1,000 locations out there. I can't answer that question today if 1,000 is enough or 1,200. We really will not find this out until we do so. But I will make an aggressive effort to increase those locations before the spring.
What was the what's the distribution year to date in the District of Columbia?
6,790.
So a third.
Out of the, yes. Out of the 19,000.
And your numbers are current as of?
September.
Okay, good.
Ms. Hewlett. A couple of questions. Were there lessons learned? I mean, we got the statistics from the other jurisdictions, and there were lessons learned that that may be applicable here?
Absolutely. You know, and the messages are exactly as you are articulating here.
Okay.
Communicate often, communicate early, and, you know, but all hands on deck. I mean, there's nobody in this communications department, bus department, anybody internally here who wants this to fail. And so, you know, go at it with as much firepower as you can, which is what we are doing. I mean, started doing this, started coming up with our plan in August. Went to all the regional meetings over the past couple of weeks here, and now ready to start in October getting it done. So that was certainly the biggest message that we heard both from Chicago and from Boston.
And then, you know, and I saw, we heard you talk about different ways you're going to get the word out, and you know, and that hopefully that would include like television and cable, I think cable and all this.
We will look at that. Our biggest priority right now is communicating directly to our customers
right
there. And one of the big things that we're looking to get some benefit from is buses or announcements on our bus annunciator.
Right.
So where buses have that capability, you'll be hearing that. If you're a bus rider, you will hear that starting in late October, November, that in both in English and in Spanish,
okay,
the transfers are going to be going away in January. So there's that. I also wanted to bring up the issue of tokens had come up earlier, and that was an issue that, of course, we dealt with last year. And I actually tried this last night on the bus. You can load a token onto a smart trip card. So the solution that we are discussing with social service agencies is you have your free smart trip card that you give to your client. Your client, you give them the smart trip card and the token. The combination of the both of those, and it's very fast to do. You load the token, you put your smart trip card on there, and there's your 3 hours of transfer. But you've got to hold on to that
right
smart trip card.
It's complicated.
It was very, I didn't believe it either, but I did it last night, and it worked.
Well, one other thing, I appreciate your saying, Mr. Cato, that you will aggressively look at the other places, locales where you can get the smart cards and do the unloading as well, because I think that is a big issue.
And second round, anyone on second round? Mr. Linton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Wilson, you mentioned the lapse contract on the passes and several other challenges that we as an agency would have if we as a board felt that we weren't ready to move forward with this. What corrective action plan could you put in place to rectify all that? I know that you can do emergency procurement. I would assume that the persons that are providing our passes would love to have an extension of some temporary contract. So there are things that you can do none of those are insurmountable in that regard. So, you know, I'm not sure what the thinking of the board is, but we might want to look at what contingency plan you could have in place, if there was not the readiness for this to go forward. Second point, the balance transfer that Mr. Zimmerman made reference to, I think I heard that it would be 2010.
No. I'm sorry, sir. That was for the passes to be added to the Smart Trip card.
Okay, the passes to be added. Let's go back to that. Is that a software issue? Is that part of our transitioning with the Cubic system? Is that what's driving that? That was the...
I heard a yes.
Yes. And like I said, I'm not the Smart Trip person here. They're actually meeting about this this subject right now, about what the features are going to be with the next upgrade there. But my in my discussion with staff, that capability of loading loading passes onto a Smart Trip card will be something that will be available early 2010 as part of the next issue with Cubic.
Is that another part of that program that has been delayed? Because I understand that it had been thought that that issue was resolved, that the software corrections that would be needed to do that would have occurred some time ago.
And I can't speak to that, but I think we can get back to you about what specifically was the history of that particular component.
What's the answer to his first question?
The first question was, can we put contingencies in place? Yes.
You don't have them at the moment, but you could think.
No, it's prudent for us to look at contingencies. Again, you know, from my perspective as a general manager, I'm recommending that we move forward with this program. And again, I will report back of what success we have in aggressively placing other equipment to purchase your Smart Trip card or to upgrade it throughout the region on those numbers at the next time we meet. But again, whenever we do this, it's going to be a change for our riders, and there will be some impacts. But I feel that we will be ready.
Now, someone else on second round. Someone else. And I think we have just one factual question, with two factual questions. The January, in terms of running out of transfers, I mean, we will have our order will be run out at that point, but there'll still be transfers in the system available to us, won't there? If we wanted to use them.
So what happens when you order transfers, they come with each specific date printed on them. So that's January 14 is the last time.
For the next time we discuss this, can we get some fiscal impact statements on delay?
Yes.
Can we do that?
Yes.
That way we'll have all the information we need. Now, I would suggest that the next time we discuss this be at the board meeting. Are you inclined to do that? Because there's an urgency to this. Huh?
Perhaps, depending on, I mean, at the same time, I'd like the next time we discuss it to be time when the staff is ready to do it.
Well, that's the question.
It could be 4 weeks from now.
I would recommend that we wait until November.
So you'll come back to us. You'll come back to us with a complete report on all of these issues.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Hutchins.
Just coming back on the question of the balance transfer, because I'm hearing that this can happen today. It's happening today. And so I think I'd like to hear some clarification as to what we consider, to your point that you were making, that it could not occur, the concern that you had about it.
My concern was that they said they weren't going to do it.
Well, they're saying, but
we don't
in eliminating the transfer is one part of it. But today, the balance transfer occurs across the region. Is that so?
No, that's not. No.
Well,
right now, the balance. My understanding.
Well, it could occur.
Yes. Let me, again, I'm not the Smart Trip person. My understanding was that the board took action, I believe, in 2004, authorizing the concept of the balance transfer, assuming that all the regional bus agencies were equipped with smart trip capability. That's not the case right now.
But there is one that hasn't done it.
Well, if I am seeing, and I'll have to use only a smart trip card to verify this, that if you go from bus to rail and your deduction occurs on the bus and vice versa, that reduction is there.
You're asking that, is that the case
yes,
right now?
It is, yes.
No,
and I'm hearing that.
No, the case is only between
rail to bus.
Rail
yes,
to bus,
it,
exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
And let me add, this has been the subject of repeated slippage. I and others have asked again and again and again. The last time I asked, which was, I want to say 10 days ago, there's still a new a date for this to take effect.
Wow.
And this is very troubling. And at some point, like at the next, why do I say this? At the next meeting, I would request a full report on what is holding up the balance transfer.
And in fact, that's what I was going to suggest, Mr. Okay. Chair, that we do bring that back as part of that report.
Put it back and let's have a full explanation of why this is not moving forward, because it is unfair to bus riders that they cannot do what rail riders are doing, which is in terms of this transfer. And there's going to be impact once the paper transfer is eliminated across the board.
And as well as financial impacts of it.
There will be
well, there is a financial impact. And the last I heard, it was $5 to $6 million. Mm-hmm. And that, I don't know whether that number still has vitality or not. I think it's an old number. Let's have the updated number on that as well. But anyway, all of this will come to a head.
Board will convene in 3 minutes.
This meeting, can I say the meeting is adjourned?
For you to do.
Are we going into executive session?
First, we have to go into public session, which we're waiting 3 minutes.
Oh, are we going to public session to go into private session? We couldn't have done that here.